Let's introduce it back to the evening. There's going to be 14 writers, and they're going to read the work of Joseph Sweeney. Many of you know who Joseph Sweeney is, and a very much loved contributor to OVAIL for a long time. He passed away in May 2021. So I'll just read his bio for you here. Joe Sweeney was a much beloved writer and poet who mostly wrote humorous short stories. Joe passed after a short illness in May 2021. He was a regular at OVAIL since its outset in 2007 and was well known to local Cork writers in particular. A number of Joe's poems and experts from his short stories will be read by many of these local writers. Joe lived just outside of Blarney in Cork and taught in Cork's North Mon Secondary School for many years before becoming a full-time writer. He was a member of a number of Cork writers' groups. He also lived and taught in France and Spain. He was born in Dublin and graduated from UCD with an honors master's degree in Anglo-Irish literature in 1983, soon after which he became a prize winner at the Stowe Writers' Week for a humorous essay in 1984. He won the Cross National University Short Story Award in 1984 and first prize at the Stowe Writers' Week for another humorous essay in 1985. He won first prize again at the Stowe Writers' Week in 2014, followed by a Brian McMahon Short Story Award in 2015. He was shortlisted for the Francis McManus Award in 2017 and the Los Gatos Le Stowe Writing Festival Prize in California, the Brian McMahon Short Story Award in 2018, and the Bray Literary Festival Prize in 2019. He's been widely published in magazines, newspapers, and collections in the UK and Ireland, and has had work broadcast multiple times on national radio. Tilting at Will Mills, published in September of 2014, is a multi-award-winning collection of humorous stories and essays. It contains four prize-winning pieces, including two first prizes from the Stowe Writers Week competitions and one shortlisted by Reader's Digest. Tilting at Windmills, said Joe himself, is like Don Quixote charging at all kinds of monstrosities and pomposities to see what laughter I can release. Whether stories, this is Alan Tilley's comments about Tilting at Windmills, he says, whether stories, sketches, vignettes, dramas, this collection always raises a laugh or a smile. The author is a wonderful practitioner of that unmanageable Irish trait of being both funny and serious at the same time. Alice Taylor says, a view of life that will put a smile on your face. And then Moss McCarthy says, a marvelous anthology of humorous urgings which brings to the world a healing and uplifting humanism. I think a lot of us can relate to that when it comes to Joe's work. A great appreciator of laughter and someone who often reminded us of the importance of laughing. We're going to have a few readers come up now, so we're going to just try and move through them. I'll get the ball rolling, sure, while I'm here. So each reader is going to have 5 minutes each, so I'll just call them out as we go through, okay? So I'll go first. And this is taken from Tilting at Windmills, and it's called Good Weather Report. I think it's fitting given what's going on in Glasgow over this couple of weeks and all the protests that happened over the weekend around the world. I think this is a good fitting weather report that Joe left us. Good Weather Report. It will be dry this morning as soon as the rain stops. Winds will be moderate, not during the storm, of course, but after that passes in the late afternoon, there will be nothing to worry about. In fact, it will get a little warmer this evening, with temperatures in the low teens. And though more heavy rain will follow, even turning to flooding during the night, It will then be dry almost tomorrow. Now on Thursday, we are expecting Hurricane Harry. Needless to say, the winds will be fair from moderate while Harry is doing well. So get ready to batten down the hatches over the weekend. The snow that we've been seeing in high places shouldn't last too long, as it's early August and summer is at its height. There will be extensive fog over the Midlands tomorrow, but this should clear by the early afternoon. Wednesday, we'll see the current prolonged spell of overcast weather in the north finally clearing off towards the east, making for some fresh clouds from the west to be followed, as we have said, by Harry from the south on Thursday. Now, the long-term forecast. Downpours, though heavy, are unlikely to persist for the whole month. A few weeks at most. The weather is generally likely to improve in the autumn, as it's simply not possible, given the laws of probability, for it to go on raining day after day for much longer. Though, having said that, maybe it could. We here at the Met Office are keeping our fingers crossed, and we would advise the public to do the same. Hang on until tomorrow. Keep your hopes high, even if the temperatures go low. Just keep scarf and gloves handy and buy a stock of all-weather umbrellas. They should last you for a couple of outings anyway. Let's just try to keep positive as the flooding and storm force winds persist. Keep your eyes peeled for any lovely rainbows, and God willing, we'll be out of this current spell of bad luck before long. News is just coming in of another Arctic winter for this year, but global warming is still a scientific fact, and no doubt we will eventually benefit. One day, soon, we can all look forward to a good posting. And we have Sheila O'Flynn next.
One of Joe's five-word poems. Guilt. We lie in the orchard, staring up at a sky rich with apples and stars. It is August. The May blossoms have long since blown. The red fruits weigh in the twilight. Blackberries are tangled along the wall. We picked some earlier, but they broke in the abattoir of our hands, led away through our fingers. We have crushed our secrets between our bodies. We lie now, two insomniacs, in the aftermath, in the silence of night. Unable to dream, unable to sleep, utterly awake. While the world around us slumbers effortlessly, wishing we could put the berries back on the branches. Aww.
And we're going to have Ed O'Dwyer.
Thank you. I'm just going to read this very short little piece from Thou Shalt Not Laugh. So it's a kind of collection of vignettes in Tuntik at Willamels. This is the fourth one. It's called Suffer Little Children. Adults may be guarded and disguise their activities in church. Children are more upfront. If not restrained, they can pull at daddy's hair just while he is striving to look devout. Baby one may be testing his new teeth on daddy's ear, though, and simultaneously scratching his face to see if he can get a reaction. Meanwhile, baby two is launching an attack from the rear, punching at buttocks and pulling mammy's jumper beyond stretching points. Parents try to pacify their children, and you will sometimes catch them twisting startled grimaces into expressions of wonder and divinity. Children have an uncanny gift for choosing the wrong moment for their escapades. Their behavior may be exemplary during the noisy collection, as they are too busy wondering if they might be able to remove something from the page without being seen. During the hushed consecration, however, they sense their chance, and the church can sound like a disorganized creche with all the screeching and howling. When it's time to go up for communion, children, if not held back, charge up in a savage competition for hosts, even tripping up competitors if necessary. On their way back down to the altar, their faces contort with suppressed laughter, until they arrive back at their seat and kneel down. Once back in their seats, of course, they no longer feel like laughing.
Thanks for that, Ed. Nice one. And while we are still on Zoom, Julie, if you would like to read.
Thanks, Ciarán. This is a lovely way to, I suppose, to commemorate Joe and his writing. He was definitely one of the friendliest people when I started attending O'Vale a long time ago. And as a writer, he was inspiring and very encouraging. I really like this poem. I came across it in the Five Words Anthology, Volume 6, and it's entitled Flame. At the heart of the flame, the truth is burning. Inside the autumn house, a shadow turning with a candle. In a mirror, a painting of a horseman, a huntsman in flamboyant red, above a kill casting a cold eye on life and death. The moon is drifting, the season turning. Deep within the flame, the truth is burning.
We have Colin Scully up next, please.
Thank you, Karen. I'm just going to read not something by Joe, but a little reminiscence I wrote of my own about Joe Sweeney. It's called An Evening with Joe Sweeney. One winter's evening, no one else turned up to the writer's group, except me and Joe. We sat in the bar of the River Lee Hotel and discussed the other two, who had surreptitiously scribed off to a poetry reading in the Isle of Maxima. They would be late, but never came. Poor communications, we both agreed. Thinking back, that was the seed of Joe's alienation from the group. Monday was a bad night for him, he said a few months later. He liked to get to O'Vale early. He stopped coming for a while. But that particular evening, we didn't read, as too was difficult for close analysis, but mulled over my coffee and a small beer. I was in the mood, having been bawled out of it by my younger female boss at work. Totally unwarranted. He listened kindly to my grievances, interested as he always was, threw some aphorisms at me. Comic quips lightened my burden, gave me some insight to his secret life. He talked about his time teaching in South of France, visiting with the school principal and his wife, entertaining them with his piano virtuosos in their front room. I was almost there. He owned a house in Paris, rented it out, he said, was free to take a holiday there every year in that or an equivalent apartment, which he never did while I knew him. Though he always talked about taking a little sojourn in Paris. I loved his humour and his friendliness, always a welcoming smile at the hayloft stationed at the bar, just there where Michelle is now. Always a generous comment about your poem. I loved his one-liners. I'm a stowaway on the ship of dreams. I live in a world of music. And he did. I never heard him play, but loved the music and his words. He was idiosyncratic, a student of literature rather than life. Joe gave everything to his characters. His retired cop solving murders in LA, Maeve, the student hating teacher, bent on undermining her principal. Novels, He was writing a horror story every day for 100 days of COVID. That evening, I was glad of him and his advice. I never got the chance to tell him that I had cut the ropes of work and floated like him in the dreamy bay of full-time writing. I admired him so much for the courage, his courage in making that choice. With COVID and everything, I had not seen him for 2 years. I was glad of Zoom, and that just before the end, we put him back into our virtual writer's group. He did not share his screen during those few meetings. He said he had technical problems. I think now maybe he was keeping something from us. But I remember with fondness that evening in the Riverlea Hotel when we chatted and mused gently on our lives.
We'll have Conor McManus up in this space next month's guest.
Thanks, Ciarán. I think Joe was one of the first people in the writing world that I met when I came to Cork, and he actually directed me to Obey, which has had a big impact on my writing. I'm credited with that. A few years ago, myself and Joe decided to set up. He was always his own man. A few years ago, we decided to set up a writer's group. But we couldn't agree on the night, the time, or the venue. So what we could agree on was there'd be no poems and no poetry, and no poets. We were adamant about that. It was going to be a prose group. So the first night came along anyway, and Joe was going to do the first reading, and he buzzed out a poem. And to make matters worse, it was a long poem. That was Joe. So this is a piece I'm going to read. It's actually, it's from his book, Dipping of Women's. It's called Age. I just read part of it. I want to read some of Joe's prose. Isn't that good, isn't it? There's a poem there. Age, the problem with Ruben. Some years after leaving university, I ran into my old college friend, Ruben. We were teenagers when we first met as freshers. But poor Ruben was a changed man, a mockery of his former self. When I commented on this, he said, "Well, I am 31, you know," as if this made everything all right. We had some chat about the old days, but it wasn't the same. I felt let down somehow. Several years later, I ran into him again, only to find that he was no longer even 31. Apparently, he was now 37 or 42 or something. Every time I met him, he seemed to be talking about his age. He seemed obsessed with it. Age is of no interest to me, not since I finally settled the matter to my own convenience. Why waste your life chasing around after elusive numbers? I've never agreed with age as a concept. It keeps altering from year to year. What is the point of chopping and changing like Henry V did with every passing year? No wonder faith and integrity are on decline. People need something to anchor them. Otherwise, they will just drift like seaweed on the tide. If you keep letting yourself go with every birthday that flows in and out, where will it all end? One must put one's foot down. Thank you.
Thanks, McConnell. Every of Max.
So Joe was a man of feelings, personal charm.
Can you hear me?
Thanks, Ronald. He had an immense personal charm, and he had a very irreverent way of take you to task when you're out of line. And he would always read a critique of every kind of hastily written impulse song. So the potential, you were getting there, Mads, you were getting there. So, and when I said you've arrived, I think you've landed with that one. Because you like home now. But for Tom Hilfiger, if you like singing for him. But, you know, he always called me little nickname, and I did a little nickname back for him. But I did delight in Joe, because he was like a little taste of Victorian parlour humour, you know. There was never a trace of anything vulgar, you know, language-wise. So very covert. And he flaunted, I'd say, enjoy your sash in and out at your own time and your own kind of schedule. So this song is kind of my little reply, because he always says, Mags, someday I will arrange and compose them all with you. And I see you do the Shostakovich piano for this piece. And he was going to do minuets and gavots. And it was all going to happen. Of course, the inner sanctum, no, my daughter, went out of there, but I never got there. So this is kind of my goodbye dream that we had, we always talked about. So, can you hear me now? Okay, we will grab the COVID task on you as we have.
Be gone.
Okay. So I call it a Minuetto Giuseppe, or the Giuseppe Fresh In. La 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 la. I did the master sketches for your pictures that you hope they print. And if the editor would fancy them, you might just make a mint. When we lunched for the first draft, you looked down at the league and you visualize each story you describe them for me. Sorry, the guitars. And I'd say, Joe, what are you going to give up for Lent? Oh, my dear, that would be vanity. Oh, peacock's best of luck with that. And it's for you, I listen to each little composition that I play. And you promised to play piano at your salon soiree. Yes, you promised to play piano at your salon. You went to Giuseppe, the Sweeney Sashen. And then I appointed myself wing woman when you won in the stall on that day. Now I was the peacock as my wing of sashay. On Sunday, Miss Eleni, your rich polished tone bathed the airways in your voice alone. And I said, Joe, those fables are implausible, I'd say. But drops of truth on each page, on each leaf, a grain. And you renew and listen to each little composition that I play. And you promise to play piano in your garden soiree. And you promise to play piano at our salon soiree. All together now. La 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 la. On, on. La la la. On, on. And you went to Giuseppe, the sweet sachet. Bishop's tongue writers as you held the chair, and we fit it and edit your words if we dared. And he'd say, Max, you're slowly just getting there. And one night, oh my dear, you've arrived. I think you've landed, I declare. And I walked home on air. And he'd review and listen to each little composition that I played. And he promised to play piano at our garden soiree. And I'd review and listen to each little composition that I played. And he promised to play
play piano at her garden soiree. Ra-ba-dum-bum, da-da-dum-bum-bum. You went to Giuseppe, the sweetie sachet. Amen, you went to Giuseppe, a sweetie sachet. And you reviewed and listened to each little composition that I played, and you promised to play piano at her garden.
Class, mate. Absolutely class, like. Unreal. Best lunch in our bed following that.
Hi, can you hear me? Yeah, okay.
You can't hear it.
You can't? Mags, that was amazing. I'm going to read one of Joe's five-word poems. It's untitled, but it says, "To Whom It May Concern." Recently, I got a new kind of spectacles called varifocals. Suddenly, I was seeing things I had never seen before. Extraordinary things started happening. I saw a platypus in a hoodie wheeling a trolley out of a supermarket, pursued by a dog with two sheep. The duck-billed platypus then rammed a car with his trolley and did considerable harm. There was a crunching metallic sound, and then the car disintegrated, turned into a flock of crows who, along with the platypus, the sheep, and the dog, all flew away. I suppose it can only mean one thing. Shouldn't have gone to Specsavers.
Thanks, Ben. This one. We'll have Billy Ramsden next, Billy, if you're there.
I'm here.
Oh, good to see you, right? Yay! Yay!
Up the rebels. Greetings from Spain, from Barcelona. When I think of Joel, I think of a character of extraordinary mischief and extraordinary wisdom. And there are two characteristics that you don't often see combined in a person. And he had both of them in spades. He was a wonderful man and a wonderful writer. And I know what a loss he is to our community, the community of O'Vale, and beyond that, the wider literary community of Cork, and beyond that, the wider literary community of Munster, and beyond that. And there's memories as well that I have of him that come to mind on a night like this, watching all of you perform, and they bubble to the surface, you know, but one that comes back to me is, in particular, is at the Bantry Literary Festival. I know many of you would have been there over the years. One particular night with Joe, and he probably wasn't a great drinker, but that night he had definitely had a few drinks, and so did I, and we stayed up for many hours after the readings, and we set the world to rights. And I often think about, I've thought about that conversation a lot, you know, in the months since his death. So has anybody read A Polyester Wedding yet? I take that as a no. I'll read it anyway.
Perfect.
Somebody else, yeah? I'm in the clear. I'm just going to read it. A Polyester Wedding by Joseph. After a disaster of a wedding, where most of the guests got food poisoning, we made a swift exit and headed off on our honeymoon. We were taking a motoring trip through Europe, destination the Grecian Isles, where we had booked a luxury hotel. The sat-nav in our hired car, however, broke down, and we ended up in a freezing little hamlet in the Swiss mountains, just before we ran out of petrol. And as we sat in the car that night and blew into our hands, we had our first fight ever, and we were already wondering how long you had to be married before you could get divorced. Early next morning, though, we saw a troop of English tourists with their children dressed in lederhosen, flouncing along singing, "Here we go gathering nuts in May, nuts in May, nuts in May. Here we go gathering nuts in May on a cold and frosty morning." We laughed so much. That St. Bernard moment, I think, was when our honeymoon was resuscitated. It may even have saved our marriage. Thanks a million, and here's the joke.
Oh my God, Billy. Next we have Michelle DeLay, please.
I didn't know Joe very well, just through O'Vail, and it's really lovely to have his company and his family and friends tonight. I think he definitely stood out to me as somebody who extremely classy. Yeah, I think extremely classy man, I think, who saw the beauty in everything, the humour in everything, and was just so joyful to be around. So I think everyone can aspire to you know, take after him in that way. So I'm going to read a five-word challenge poem that Joe wrote in March 2011, so it's over 10 years old, and it's untitled. We climbed Knocknarine Mountain to visit Queen Mary's tomb. Just you and me and a wind that would skin you. We stood and held each other and looked over Ireland until the sun changed the clouds from gold to the colour of blood. As we descended, the sun was gone, the land shadowy as history. We shared the last of the potato crisps on that old bog road, but we were still hungry.
Thanks, Michelle. We'll have Seamus Harrington next, please.
Thanks, Kieran. So many happy memories with your trips to Limerick, Dublin, borrowing the pole washer, walks, and very short walks. There were afternoon tea, piano recital, and guitar. Going to buy a new car. And I tried to prevent him. He sent me this a long, long time back. The secrets of cats. Eyes glued to the laptop, Jeremy takes a cautious bite of toast. Amanda is looking out the kitchen window and frowning. Jeremy turns his head. She mutters something, then disappears out the door and down the back garden. The rhubarb's broken, she says when she returns. He's away in the Dow Jones. She goes on talking, her words lost in the angry clang of saucepans and cutlery as she unloads the dishwasher. "It's hardly Ling Lang, is it?" she says, the only sentence to reach him intact. "Mm-hmm." Jeremy claws the mouse, darts it forward into the footsie. Ling Lang, the neighbour's cat, disappeared almost a year ago. Amanda had comforted her distraught neighbour at the gate. Ursula Martin had mobilised her husband around the neighbourhood in search of the missing animal. The following day, she led a search party of bewildered children down the road, pinned posters on trees on the river walk, attached them to shop windows between three for the price of two offers, and even the church porch. Underneath a picture of their huge orange Asian cat with trailing whiskers and an inscrutable oriental eyes were the words, "Has anyone seen Ling Lang? Reward offer." "I'm sure he'll turn up," Amanda had said, to comfort her neighbour, secretly praying he didn't. Ling Lang was a one-cat army, a despot. Amanda hadn't been able to leave a door or window open during his reign, or as she now referred to it, the Ling Lang dynasty. She found him slinking down the stairs once, commandingly, like Nero or Caligula, descending the steps of Imperial Rome. She found faint depressions on the bed and cat's hair on the pillows. Not wanting to risk souring the relations with her neighbours, she never breathed anything to Ursula. They'd never give up Ling Lang anyway. They'd cling onto him like drowning people to a raft. Amanda just smiled through gritted teeth and told Ursula Martin she'd keep an eye out for Ling Lang. She meant it too. She'd been doing little else for years. "You think he might come back after all this time, Jeremy?" she repeats. "Hmm?" he murmurs doubtfully. Amanda flicks a quick side glance at her husband. "It's all right for Jeremy. He has his work every day, meetings, colleagues, lunches. She only meets the women in the book and cookery group once a fortnight. These morning exchanges are important to her. The way Jeremy gets absorbed in that laptop, she sometimes feels like she isn't really there. It's like it's just her and Jeremy's holograms interfacing, having virtual conversations. She feels like an aging Princess Leia, exiled at the kitchen sink, breaking up, crackling, trying to talk to her husband many miles away, alone, online, in a distant galaxy of investment, stocks, and shares."
Thank you.
Thanks, Seamus. So we have four more to go. We have Rab Urquhart next.
Stole my thunder.
Huh?
Julie Goose stole my thunder.
Oh, there's many things to. Okay, so. Yeah.
You could read it again. Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
You can have it.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Exactly. It'll sound different, Rob. So I have this thing when I go in the library and I'm looking for a book. I read it years ago and it said, "Look at page 69 if you want to see if it's going to be a good book." So here we go, this is page 69 from Joe's book. Misunderstandingly, generally making clear that any rumours blowing around the town concerning, this must be a misprint, concerning guests at Humberton Hall were nothing but chaff in the breeze. All our guests would assure the police were top notch. We had no reason to think otherwise. A little bohemian at times, well-travelled, artistic maybe, that we might concede. But none of them would ever do anything in controversial British law. Why, we owed it to the colonials to keep the thing ship-shape and above board at home. Reports that one of our guests had been seen swaying on one of the balconies as if he had smoked or sniffed a bit of too much some illegal substance of other were damn lies. We assured the police that on the night in question, the guest in question was in safe custody of Lolly and Emily, and there was never at any point a danger to himself or the public. They said that someone else was seen on the balcony in the early stages of undress, calling down names at a traffic policeman. They even had some cock and bull story about our guests hurling sections of melon down on the bobby.
Nice one, Rob. Right, go up with the contingency plan. And, right, so we have Rosie O'Regan next.
I'm in a similar boat to Rav because you read what I had planned to read. whatever, Kieran.
We're supposed to be coordinating it.
Yes.
That was you, Rav.
Well, I decided very last minute, so that's probably my own fault. I suppose I'd like to just say that, it's really lovely to be here and to hear everybody's memories and experiences of Joe and how some of you knew him so much better than I did. Like, he was here definitely when I first started coming, and I was probably a little bit not sure of Joe at the start. You know, I guess I thought he was kind of prim and proper, and maybe I kept him at arm's length for a little while, and probably for quite a while, actually, until he kind of found myself sitting beside him one night. I think it was in Mainz. I don't remember what we were talking about, but we were talking, and I suddenly went, "Oh, this guy's really cool. Like, you know, he's, you know, I had this prejudice, I suppose, like we all have our prejudices." And that was a wake up moment for me about books and covers. And simply that. He's great and really lovely to hear all of your experience and to know just how mischievous he was. And standalone kind of person, I guess, Joe. Like, anyway, hearing the stories, and I'm being surprised, and I feel like I'm getting to know him after the fact, which is sad for me. So my loss there. I'm sure Joe's all right wherever he is. So I had planned to read what Kieran read. So obviously that was read. So I would like to ask his sister over here, who I met, I should send off, if you have a favourite story here or anything that you might have to hear.
I'm sorry, man. When you open a
this one's not in the book. So he's read it here before.
Yes.
An abbreviated life. If no one else is going to read that, that's okay. That's the one. And it's short. It's nice and short.
Perfect.
Yes. This is the one that you want.
You don't have to stick to the
book. No.
Did you want to read
it? No.
It's like all reading, so we'll see how it goes. And for Joe's family, especially his sister over here. So there he goes. Elizabeth, this is for you, Elizabeth. An abbreviated life. Mr. and Mrs. O'D had great plans for their son. They thought the world of him. Gerard was a VIP in their eyes. His father, a CEO at the IFA, had studied in UCD, from which he had an MBA. He now drove a BMW, and his mother worked as a pro with the IPGWU. Most of the neighbours' children were sent to the local BBC, but the ODs decided to send their son to a private CES. They felt that education was the way to go. Months before his leaving search, Gerard God for short, applied to the DAO for various third level courses. His first choice was TCD. He wanted to study for a BSc in computing. As a backup, he also applied to DCU, DIT, and UCD. Luckily, he was accepted into Trinity. Well, 4 years flew by and Jared passed all his exams and was awarded a science degree, QED. His parents arranged a party and sent an invitation to friends and relations marked RSVP. But just days before the party, Jared parked his bicycle and was crossing O'Connell Street when he wanted to post a CV to the GPO when his iPhone rang. He began rushing Frank and his bag, where all his computer accessories had become entangled. The USB lead for recharging his iPad had become entangled with his HDMI cable, an AC-D adapter for his AC-IS iPad, and an LED torch for his bike. While he was trying to separate them, he stumbled into a pothole that the OPW had been meaning to locate and found himself in the path of an ESB van. He was knocked to the other side of the road where he was again struck by an SUV. He was also caught by a bus coming in the opposite direction from CIE. There was no doubt of any of this as the whole thing was caught on CCTV. Miraculously, though, Jared was alive. He crawled to the pathway, determined to get to his graduation ceremony and party and maybe one day get his PhD. A girl who worked as an SNA stopped, called 999, and requested an ambulance ASAP. A girl who worked as an SNA stopped, called 999, and requested an ambulance ASAP. She then texted her friend with trembling fingers, OMG, hope you will be okay. The HSE came, and when the ambulance men gave Jared CPR and he regained consciousness, they brought him to A&E and rambled him along on a trolley for an MRI. Due to a recent outbreak of MMRA, it's delayed. Jared lifted his head and the nurse, seeing this promising sign of life, inquired if he had PHI, at which point he fell back and died. The parents were grief-stricken. They tried to get His Excellency Bishop J.P. McGovern, S.G., to officiate at the funeral mass, but he had to go away urgently on the missions after a report. Had congregated outside the bishop's palace. Jared's parents had to settle for Father H.J. Albright, O.S.A., Opus Sanctorum Anglorum. As they stood at the grave, Father A.J. Albright said that it was sad that a human life is foreshortened, but at least Jared's death had been mercilessly quick. Jared's parents tried to glean what police they could from Father Albright's words, and the fact that their son had at least died with letters after his name, Jared O.D. B.S.C. R.I.P.
I remember Joe said that on this mic. Unreal, fair play, Rosie. More power. That's why I went first to read, because I only decided what I was going to read right before I started as well. The two of us were caught in the same boat there, so sabotaged your previous effort. But next we'll have Daw Harding. Oh, please.
Am I all right, Brad?
What?
I'd like to thank Paul and Rosie for keeping O'Bale going during the lockdown. And it's a pity sorry for reading this number, I forget everything. It's pity that others didn't have the experience that Rosie had. Once you got to know Joel, that was it. You would never forget him. I was hoping to read his Sunday miscellany piece. It's too long. And my wife used to use it in school, in her classes. She just thought it was so brilliant. Anyway, there are two sides to Joe, the comedian and the serious. As we all know, he was a very funny fellow and could not resist taking the comical side to any serious situation. Even when he was staring death in the face in his last weeks, he could still crack a joke about the awful situation he was experiencing and facing. But it was the serious Joe that I was more interested in. We went to the Restored Festival a few years ago when he won the first prize, not the first time, and for one of the short stories, and we had a great old time. I read lots of the serious short stories along with the comical ones, and I must say that I always thought and told him so that he wasn't concentrating enough on his more literary side of his writing. He asked me to read his brilliant first Gothic novel back in 2008. And I have to say, I was nagging him to persist in getting published, along with a collection of short stories, Gothic as well. I even gave him the title, The Hounds of Mam Turk. If that was one thing that Joe was weak on, it was titles. And we had many discussions on that subject. I hate to say that he was a great procrastinator. Having said that, Joe has entrusted these writings to me with a view to eventually publication, and I hope sincerely to honor his request. Anyway, this is one of his poems that he sent me. I can't remember that. It's called Witness, and I think it was after he had seen that child that was washed up on the beach during the bloody crossing of the waters. It's called Witness. Silent prosecutor, nature's software. Through religions, ideologies, you see what is. Miniature planet. Information satellite, arbiter, transmitting truth to the vast depot of the soul where nothing seen can be unseen. You welcome to your surface light, black, white, all colors across your borders, world's victims. Drowning migrants flounder to your translucent arc, pass through your truth-sensitive skin, seeking the fabled garden of conscience. African mother and child walking for miles before dying of thirst. Syrian toddler tugging at rocks, bigger than himself, blinded by tears, searching for his family, his world, buried beneath. Oh, little eye, what marvels and atrocities you see. Earth, sea, sky, sun, moon, stars, quick as light. You see quicker than trains to Auschwitz, bombs to Nagasaki, planes to Twin Towers. Earthquakes, volcanoes, tornadoes, tsunamis, atomic clouds, and rainbows. With optic nerve, you stare back at billions of years. See stars dead before Earth was born. Riding in like alien magi, bearing gifts, lit with ancient news. With better technology, you've seen perhaps back to the beginning, the great setting out, nothing becoming something, eternity stirring, curling up like a fetus to birth itself into time, to breathe light, constellations, pin down the void with eyes to look afar to our cradle, show you dark pupil its bright blossoms, a universe fruiting like a great apple tree. and what on earth it all might mean. I still see.
My son Donnie. And our final reader for this section, we'll have Amanda Rell with Philip Horne, please.
This is a story that Joe and I had a long-term plan to do collaboration in Dublin. But we could never agree on a date. I think that's a kind of
a common theme.
So I'm very happy to kind of realise this dream with Joe's brother Manuel, and I'll be giving some musical effects.
Now there's two accents in this. One is it's about a Dublin fella who went to find love, the meaning of love and soul in Tibet. It's called a fable. And there's also an Indian lady in Tibet who immigrated to Tibet from India. It was a late summer. We were in Tibet. Myself and many pilgrims climbing in the holy mountains. We come to a last stretch of road, turn the last bend, and there, a mile or two before us, lay our destination. Vast towering walls, great gates of solid gold. This was the ancient fabled mountain garden. Some said it didn't exist, but I was a believer. An old woman by the roadside. An old woman beside the roadside with a patch over one of her eyes squinted at me. Would you like some water? She said, fresh and cold from the mountain streams. Yes, I said, thank you. She poured the water from a jug she was carrying and it glittered like silver in the sun, and she handed it to me in the beaker of water, and I noticed her watching me keenly with a wrinkled eye. I finished drinking and handed her back the beaker. It is an extraordinary garden, she said, looking towards the huge golden gates in the distance. She smiled. You're not even from outside. On summer evenings, you can smell the fragrances, hear the birds singing. They say that inside the fragrances are heavenly, she frowned. But it is difficult to get inside, for some impossible. I finished drinking and handed her back the cup. I have a key, I told her, wiping my mouth. I brought it. I bought it in the market in Chengdu. A Chinese key, very good, but this is Tibet, she said. And the sacred garden has no ordinary lock. It is no ordinary garden. She lowered her head and scuffed the earth with her foot. After a while, I felt her eye on me again. Look around, she whispered. Many travelers come here day after day with keys they have bought in Chengdu or hotels in Shanghai or Beijing. She raised her hand and pointed at the long line of people coming up the mountain. By the time they reach here, they are tired, hungry, searching for the wondrous garden they have heard of in song and story. They all have their keys, but I have seldom seen the gates open. And some keep trying, insisting, until the key twists or breaks. I've seen them cry with rage, grip the gates and shake them, shouting angrily through the bars. Is anyone there? Let me in. But I'm tired and hungry. I have come so far. Someone let us in. On winter nights, their cries come long and lonesome like the howl of wolves over the snow. Some hang around for a time, unable to accept that they have come so far in vain. Perhaps they come to the wrong time, in the wrong season. Perhaps they were just unlucky, out of favor with their gods. Who knows, sometimes the darkness is setting in, they remain squabbling among themselves, becoming hungrier and hungrier. I've seen them eat dogs, any animal on board, or they can catch. Some of them are very good at catching birds. The old woman looked away into the distance to where the sun was beginning its crimson descent. She leaned towards me and whispered, "So many people never get inside that garden. You may have come a long way for nothing." And as she was turning to go, she hesitated. And exactly the same moment, we both noticed a little dark thing by the roadside. She lifted it into her hands. It was a swallow. She offered it to me. I put out my hands and she placed it gently into them. "This little bird travels farther than any of these people," she said. "Thousands and thousands of miles across oceans, over Himalayan snows, hoping for everything but expecting nothing. Feel how light it is, lighter than a key. All it wanted was to go on living, but sometimes it is asking too much." She made a sign with her hand towards heaven. And just at that moment, the little black thing stirred, its tiny body smuggled in the palm of my hand. I gave it some water and some crumbs from a sandwich I had bought, and watched as the swallow raised its head and ate and drank. "That is good," the old woman said, "the water and the bread of life." The swallow stretched its wings as it testing them, and I felt the feathers tickling my skin. It was still very weak, though, and I placed it in the long grass, out of danger. Its little body so light that the blades of grass held it aloft, up off the ground, providing a perch from which it could launch itself back into the heavens as soon as it was able. The old woman smiled, gave me her blessing, and with a wave went off down the road. I continued on my journey until I stood outside the huge gates. People were gathered in a cluster around, all anxious to try their keys, but the gates never opened. The queue was long, the day nearing its end, and I felt tired after my journey. So with my key clutched firmly in my hand, I lay down on the grass. Night fell, a beautiful moon appeared in the heavens like the innocent startled eye of a newborn foal. It looked down, clear and blinking, like an eye upon sleeping on the mountainside. And to me, it seemed it was full of tender compassion and wonder. Beneath its soft gaze, my own eyelids sank and I fell asleep. Many hours later, just before dawn, I was awakened by the furious beating of wings. Before I could react, I felt something sharp landing on my arm and then something being plucked from my hand. Jumping up in alarm, I spotted a magpie, terrible but beautiful, its black and blue wings gleaming in the sinking moonlight. One for sorrow indeed, its beak was clenched around the key I had brought to open the gate. I watched in despair as with a maddening flush of its wings, it flew over the garden and dropped my key on the other side of the high wall. I jumped to my feet and cried out at the dreadful bird, but it was too late. With a mocking cackle, flew off into the grey light of dawn, fading like a fable beyond the silver trees of the mountain garden. I sank to my knees and struck the ground with my fists, angry not at the bird, but with myself and my carelessness. My long journey, the journey of a lifetime, had been a waste. I had been following a foolish dream. The key I had kept so carefully for so many miles was gone now. And then I thought, what does it matter anyway? The key from Chengdu was just like thousands of others. It was almost certainly not have got me into the garden anyway. I went to the gates and shook them. They were vast, heavy, and locked firm. I stared through the bars. The garden inside me was so beautiful, but I would never get in now. Wearily, I turned back down the mountain path. But as I was walking away, I spotted the little swallow flying up and over the gates and landing on the top of a great laburnum. The tree was in full blossom, with golden panicles hanging gracefully down, shining in the light of the rising sun. And there, from the top of the tree, just beside the garden gates, The little black swallow chirped down at me just once, and I hesitated for a brief moment. Then I heard a voice. Wait, it said. I looked around to see where it was coming from, but I could hear, see no one. I heard the voice again and realized that it was coming from inside the garden. I went back to the gates, and through the bars I could see a figure dressed in white robes hurrying down the great avenue. Wait, the gentle voice said again. I watched as the figure stooped down, picking up something and inserting it into the lock. And as if by magic, the great gate swung open. The figure stood smiling before me in the dawn light, watching me with the eyes that seemed bluer than the sky. The figure opened its arms wide in greeting. Welcome, the figure said, taking my hand and leading me into the garden. Welcome to the garden of love. It only opens from the inside.